Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have an assortment of wonderful authors of cookbooks to give you today, starting with this really, really good book by Mike Peters, who is in Berlin.
We actually can't remember whether it was Mike or Mikey.
Yeah. It's M-E-I-K-E. Sorry, Mikey. Peters. And it's called Eat in My Kitchen. And it is a delightful cookbook.
It's built on an amazing concept that the author likes to invite people into her house to cook for them. We didn't entirely understand that, but we're about
to do it.
Yeah, we're going to buy our tickets to Berlin so we can take her up on it.
Exactly.
seems like great fun. But anyway, the result is recipes that you can make for yourself at home, and you know you can make them at home because she made them in her home. So every reason to suppose that this is going to be a very useful book to add to your collection.
What an absolutely marvelous surprise to pick up this book by Mikey Peters called Eat in My Kitchen. To cook, to bake, to eat, and to treat. Mikey, I just was thrilled to death to see the wonderful recipes that you had. And not only that, but you were able to explain in your head notes the process that led you to developing these recipes, which, as I understand it, are all original.
Thank you very, very much. Yes, these are all my own recipes, or recipes influenced by my family or friends or travels. There is one recipe, it's a traditional Maltese recipe, it's a bread pudding, which is not my own recipe. The other ones are my, yes.
And you also mainly photograph these delicious,
yes,
mouth-watering photographs.
Thank you. I take all the pictures myself, and yeah, when I started my blog 3 years ago, I started taking pictures of my food. And when my publisher asked me to work on this book, they said, "We love your pictures. Don't change anything.
Oh.
Just continue taking pictures for the book now."
Nice.
Now, I want to be your friend. I understand that unlike many rich Americans and rich people of a variety of faiths, instead of making reservations for dinner, you actually make dinner and you invite friends over to enjoy.
And yes.
How did you decide to do that? It seems like a rather expensive proposition.
No, not really. I love to cook. I cook dinner every night. So at one point I just decided, okay, I might as well write about it and share what I create in my kitchen. In the beginning, I also took the pictures in the evening before we ate, which didn't look as pretty because there was artificial light. So I changed that at one point. At one point I cooked for the blog. But we have a lot of friends coming over, and so there are a lot of people around us who I can share the food with, and everybody's very happy about that. And
well,
I love to share the food.
I loved your explanation of where you're coming from. I mean, in terms of influences, and they are many, but primarily it's your childhood, your family's influence. And then your partner is actually half American and half Maltese, and you spend part of your time in Malta or Rogozo.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. It is my German mother is she's a fantastic cook, and I learned the basic techniques, cooking techniques from her, but she also taught me to trust my own senses and to develop my own style, to be brave and experiment. And the German classics like schnitzel or certain roasts and salads, there cakes as well. She taught me the basics, and then when I met my partner who grew up in Malta, obviously there were a lot of new influences coming in. We spend a lot of time in Malta, in the Mediterranean, so I learned about a lot of new recipes, but I also learned to, which was even more important, to use ingredients differently. In Malta, people, when they use citrus zest, lemon juice, lemon or oranges, they use it very generously. It's not just a pinch, they use a lot. Or fennel seeds, coriander seeds. I learned to use certain ingredients in a different way to how I used to use them before.
Well, you know, most cookbooks, my eyes glaze over as I'm reading the ingredients instructions, but yours make a lot of sense. I mean, it's kind of inspiring to know that you use a mortar and pestle still to grind things.
Yes, this is, once you've tasted whole spices ground at the mortar and pestle, you can't really go back to ground spices anymore. It's just, it makes a big difference.
Yes.
And in general, I try to keep the ingredients list quite simple. I don't like it when ingredients lists are too long, because this book is meant for people who, or I hope that people who buy it actually use it every day. This is not just for a special dinner on the weekend. So you just open your fridge and cupboard and you see, hey, what's there? What can I throw together? And I'm always impressed with recipes where you just have a few ingredients and it creates something very, very delicious without having sauces or spice mixtures or whatever. You can work with what you have in your kitchen. I love that.
Well, you have probably the most lucid explanation from a cook that I've ever read about how you get these inspirations for your recipes. And it's when you're talking about your arugula, grape, and chickpea salad with orange blossom dressing. you explain your inspiration. Could you go over that for our listeners?
It is, when the salad came, or I actually describe exactly how this salad appeared in my head. Sometimes I see one ingredient and I start thinking about a memory, and then I look somewhere else. In this salad is, it combines arugula and chickpeas. So and grapes, and I use orange blossom water. So I rinsed the arugula leaves, and I had to think of my Maltese mother's, my mother-in-law's garden, where she has the orange tree, and I had to think of this, the smell of the orange blossoms. And then I saw the grapes on the plate, and all of a sudden all these things
happen,
come together in my head. And sometimes people ask me, so how do you create your recipe? And sometimes I feel more like a tool. It just happens in my head, and then I create it. It's a very natural process. I don't have to force much. It feels like it just comes.
Well, you're very creative.
Now here's a question for you, and it's a dilemma that incidentally exists in the northeastern parts of the United States as well. But Berlin, geographically, is distinctly Northern European, which means that bright, fresh ingredients aren't available much of the year because it's just too cold to grow them. How do you cope with that? Is there good trade into vegetable markets in Berlin? I know we went to one that I thought was dominated by people from Turkey.
Yes, it's a famous market in Kreuzberg. Yes, it's true.
But what's it like? And do you just switch off and use root vegetables, or what do you do?
I try to use what the seasons offer. still, I use tomatoes, for example. I use tomatoes all year round, although in January, February, even when they come from Italy, they don't taste that amazing. So I try to stick to what the seasons offer and what grows locally or regionally or in close to the area to where I live. I believe it's still okay to get your zucchini from Sicily when you don't have the zucchinis from Poland anymore, because there are zucchinis from Poland which taste good when they're in season. But in Sicily they grow them a little bit longer. So I it's a compromise. I work with what the seasons offer, but I also sometimes I use ingredients that come from further away, although I try to avoid that as much as possible. So in winter, it's about squash and cabbages. But then sometimes, because winter is quite long in Berlin, and in February, I sometimes feel like I just need bright, colorful vegetables again, and I'm tired of winter. And then I get my zucchini and my peppers and my tomatoes and create a more Mediterranean summery dish to get into the mood for summer. It won't taste as good as the ingredients that taste when I buy them in June, July, but it gives me the feeling that I need sometimes in February or March.
Now, I liked your swordfish recipe. Now,
that, oh yeah, that's, I knew you'd pick that one up.
It seems distinctly un-German to be using a fish which is Mediterranean, but I suppose that's where the Maltese connection comes in.
Yes, because I would say most of the seafood, I eat seafood in Malta because it's so good. They catch it and then it's on your plate, and it's never as good when I buy seafood here in Germany. So. This is the seafood recipes are very much in my book are very much inspired by Malta, and what I love about Mediterranean seafood dishes is that you don't really need many ingredients. You have good quality fish, and then you have maybe like in this recipes you have the capers, the tomatoes, mint, parsley, lemon, olive oil. You don't really need that many ingredients. It's just the quality that sparks and that makes it so special.
Now, there was one recipe that really confused me, and this is a Maltese recipe. I won't even attempt to pronounce the name, but you call it rabbit pie. But then all of a sudden it becomes tuna pie.
Well, it was the national dish.
take us through that one just a
Malta.
Little bit, if you would.
No, it's actually the tuna pie recipe is inspired by a traditional lampuki pie, the Maltese lampuki pie. And lampuki is a fish that is only in season in Malta in late September, October, and then you get this delicious pie. And the rabbit came in because the rabbit is Malta's national dish, not in a pie, but in a stew. And but I mentioned in this pie recipe that I think that the pie would have been a much better choice for as the national dish for Malta, because Maltese love pies.
Oh, I see.
Now I
got it. Now I understand. So you were giving us a bit of Maltese culinary lore rather than substituting, was it Spanish mackerel for rabbit?
No. It's I mean, I know that lots of people don't really know Malta in America because it's so small and so far away. So I wanted to give a little introduction and some of the recipes to the culture, to the Maltese cooking culture.
Now you reach out far and wide for some of your inspiration here. I'm looking at a recipe for beluga lentils with pomegranate and duca.
Oh, that's delicious.
That's on my list of one to make, by the way. I already decided that. I'm a big lentil person anyhow. But it's, you have to be in touch with a bunch of other, I mean, like Egyptian. Duca is really Egyptian. I mean, it's still North African, but What would make you think of this recipe? I think you're very visually oriented, too, because you talk about looking and imagining what it looks like.
Yes, this recipe actually started with this visual idea. I love the look of beluga, black beluga lentils.
Yes.
I love their taste, but I also love how they look. And I love how pomegranate looks. And I just thought, hey, the combination of the two of them would just be stunning. And then I thought there's something missing. I want spices in there. What I like about dukkha is that you have lots of different spices and different nuts and seeds. And so this recipe came.
Yeah.
To
now
my head.
You also take traditional recipes and rework them. And the one that I found the most interesting was what you did with German potato salad. Tell us about that.
As a German, potato salad is like, it's you grow up with potato salad. This is like it's a children's birthday party staple here. So, but usually you eat it with mayonnaise and wiener sausages, and it's quite a gherkins, and it's quite a heavy. Heavy treat. And my stepfather, who is from southern Germany, he introduced me to a different recipe, which is made with a dressing of onions cooked in white wine vinegar. And it's much lighter, and you add cucumber. So it's a very light and fresh take on potato salad. And that made me think about what you can do with potato salad. So I thought, hey, why not add some pesto? And then I thought, oh, I'd like to add two kinds of pesto. I have the lemon pesto and the arugula pesto. And I was thinking it would be nice to add another vegetable, and the fava beans came in. So that's how this recipe developed.
Well, I'm going to refer to blog at this point, because you have this section called Meat in Your Kitchen that I feel reflects your approach to your blog. Is it part of your blog as well?
Yes.
Could you explain it? I'm trying to get more information about your blog.
The blog is, I started the blog 3 years ago sharing one recipe every day. I wanted to do that for at least 1 year. I managed 1 year, and then I was exhausted.
I can imagine.
It was quite intense. Not the cooking. I do that anyway. But taking the pictures, writing about it, and doing that every year, that was quite an intense experience. But I already from the beginning, I thought it would be interesting to sneak into other people's kitchens and see what they do. So I came up with this Meat in Your Kitchen concept, this feature series. and I meet interesting people who inspire me in their kitchen, chefs or artists, small food producers.
Oh, no, I got it. I was thinking M-E-A-T, not M-E-E-T.
So meet in your kitchen. Uh-huh. And so I meet them. I interview them, we cook together, and they share a recipe with me. It's a beautiful series, and it's you learn a lot about a person you meet them in the kitchen.
Yeah, I don't want you to see my kitchen. But, well, I mean, here are these elements that I would have to point out is, first of all, you have such a creative mind and a passion for food, and that meets. But you also have an enormous amount of energy and to keep tackling new and more and better recipes for everything. You, on top of that, are a brilliant, sensuous writer. I mean, you can't help but just drool reading your head notes and your footnotes and all the... Yeah, all of your, I mean, you know how to use words as well as cooking ingredients.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I try to I try to focus on what I really enjoy and what I'm passionate about, and then both the food and the writing comes out quite naturally. The photography as well. If you take pictures of something that
you have this artistic talent anyhow, so that you have an aesthetic approach to your food as well.
Yes, I studied architecture, and I enjoy nice looking things, be it food, be it fashion, architecture, design, and that definitely helps when I create the recipes for the blog or for the book, and when I take pictures of them, you want it to look nice. And I enjoy that. I enjoy to catch this right moment when the food looks really yummiest, to catch this angle where it looks like you just want to grab it and have a bite.
I have this funny feeling, in conclusion here, I have this funny feeling that at some point in the not-too-distant future, the countries of Malta and Germany are going to fight over whether or not you're a citizen of one or the other. Because it's perfectly clear from this conversation, listeners, I'm sure you catch it, that this lady is a national treasure already. As a very young person, and as I said at the beginning of this program, all I want to do is be your friend.
Yeah, and listeners, grab this cookbook. It's called Eat in My Kitchen by Mikey Peters, and it's a treasure.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mikey.
And let me know when you come to Berlin, and then I cook for you.
Oh, you got a deal there. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next book actually is it was a first for this organization, or whatever you. It's the Short Stack Cookbooks. But this is all of these recipes in a single volume, the Short Stack Cookbook, which is going to be wonderfully easy to use because it's organized around ingredients. So if you know what ingredient you want to figure out what to do with it, you just look up the ingredient and then you find an expert in the culinary field with a recipe that's reliable and simple, and you cook it.
And not only that, it's the short stack is actually also a publication.
Right.
Very, very unusual, right, in this internet age, but the producers of Short Stack, the program, Short Stack, the cookbook, also have the short stack of recipe leaflets. It's in itself an interesting story.
Now, the Short Stack Cookbook is subtitled Ingredients That Speak Volumes, and I think that explains this concept broadly, but I want one of the authors, there are two authors, Nick Fuchel and Caitlin Gorlin, to start back, Caitlin, if you will, to the concept that launched the Short Stack editions, the little books, and so forth.
Of course. So my business partner, Nick, and myself worked together in a couple of different companies, all food media. And most recently, before we were doing Short Stack, we were working together at a digital publication. And we both loved food, but I think, you know, as the media landscape was changing pretty drastically, we were getting further and further away from what I think both drew us to food media and food writing in the first place, which was cooking and recipes. And it seems obvious, but, you know, it's funny how much things have changed and how much food media has, in some ways, moved away from that.
Yeah, well, now it focuses on celebrity.
Sometimes it does, exactly. So we were eager to work on a project together that sort of stripped things back down, got us back into print, which is where we both started, and kept things simple and approachable, but also allowed authors like ourselves to show off their work in this really straightforward but beautiful and easily digestible booklet.
So most of developers, the recipe, the food writers, the small ones, most of them were food writers.
Exactly. Okay. So we were inspired by the recipe pamphlets that you often saw around the mid-century turn in the 50s and 60s and 70s that would come to you with the purchase of a fridge or, you know, a bag of flour. These companies would send you a pamphlet with recipes for their product, and they would be single subject focused recipe books, and they often had some really fun, cheeky design, and that was sort of the jumping off point for us. It was like, if we could recreate that ethos and that vibe and employ the best food writers we knew to each pick an ingredient and tackle that in a very short space of just 20 recipes, which, as you know, can be really tricky for writers to narrow it down.
Yeah,
that much.
Right.
But it was a fun challenge, and so that's where it all started, was this idea of, you know, building a platform for the authors that we knew and respected and creating something that was just a little bit different in the food media world that we hadn't seen yet, and just also creating an outlet, a creative outlet for ourselves.
Yeah, you know, it seems to be a popular idea because we keep getting books from Savor the South, which is a single ingredient, and now I just got four books from For the Good Of.
Which, oh, I haven't heard of that one yet.
Yeah, because we have garlic, avocado, greens, and something else.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that focus on single subjects is telling of how people like to cook and how people are attracted to recipes. I think in the wake of, you know, this, I don't want to say revolution, but more attention being paid to ingredients in the last 2 decades. You know, farmers markets have really just become this thing that every city in the States has.
Oh, sure.
Something Europe's known for a long time, but we're kind of just catching on, I think, in the States again, and paying much more attention to what they're eating, which is wonderful. And I think that is really a huge point of inspiration for how folks approach recipes. Instead of just saying, well, I want to make this tonight, regardless of what's in season, they go to the store, they see something beautiful on the shelf, or they go to the farmer's market and their farmer has something in season and perfect and delicious, and they take that and then they look for a recipe to use it in. So that, I think that's really appealing to people right now at home cooks, and that's definitely something that we like to do and something that we're after for our readers.
So, but you started out, and that series was pretty successful with the small books.
Yes, right. And it's still going strong. So we have 24 editions at this point. We're just about to publish our 24th.
Oh, really? Okay, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. And short stack refers to the format, but also to something else.
No, it's obviously there's a little bit of a reference to the pancake stack.
Yeah, I didn't understand why. I mean, you know, you said that in your introduction, but I didn't understand why. Do you like pancakes?
You know, I think there's not a direct story behind the pancake reference. It was more just we loved that there was a way to sum up exactly what the books were, which is this small stack of single subject ingredients that you can, you know, collect. And then it also had a food reference, which felt appropriate to us.
Okay, now, but you don't have any digital presence for these books?
We do not have a digital, there are no ebooks of the small books, and that's very intentional on our part.
Right.
They also don't have photography, which is sort of, you know, a crazy thing in this day and age where so much of how we consume food media is, you know, based on visuals. And the reason we made those choices is we were hearkening back again to this format that we love, you know, these pamphlets, right. These recipe pamphlets that are collectible and they're something you hold on to. And our third partner, Rotem Rafe, is our creative director. She designs all of the covers and illustrates all of the books. And they're really beautiful design objects. In my mind, and something that we have, you know, people collect all of them. You know, they subscribe, they have every single one. And I think you lose something. We do, yeah. Okay. And I think, you know, as much as I love the web, you know, and it's an invaluable resource, and we sell our books on the web. But as far as the actual product, I think you lose something without that tactile experience, that print experience.
Yeah, I
so
agree with
you.
So
we made that choice.
Yeah, we're about to lose another newspaper. It just doesn't seem. I do read newspapers online, but I like over coffee in the morning to turn pages.
Right.
Anyhow, so what's the jump then to going back to a more traditional format of a large cookbook?
So we never set out when we first started Short Stack Editions. I don't think it was ever a plan of ours to create a big book, a big cookbook. But as we got further into this, we started kind of realizing that there was an opportunity to put these thoughts together about ingredient-focused eating, which I was just sort of describing. We saw some of these patterns about, you know, the way that people cook now using ingredients, and that to us felt like it warranted a bigger book, and it was something that we were excited to put out in conjunction with our authors. So further, the more editions we published, the more small books we published, the more we were attracted to this idea of using ingredients as a vantage point, if you will, to talk about some of the larger patterns we were seeing in American food culture. So things like food waste and using specific ingredients in their entirety from
I like that,
if you will.
Yeah, I like that you got that in there because it's so of the moment at this point.
And it's such a huge problem. I mean, it's embarrassing that, you know, there's so much food waste in this country and yet there are still people who are hungry. And so just, I think when you focus on one ingredient, you have to get creative with coming up with a ton of recipes, and one of the ways to do that is using every part of it and figuring out ways to use it when maybe it's not the perfect apple. Maybe it has some blemishes. Maybe it's a little bit past its prime, but instead of throwing it away, you know, someone who is deeply in the midst of thinking about only apples will come up with a really interesting way to use it, whether it's jam or preserves or, you know, pickled apples or what have you. And right. So that's just one example, but, you know, I think there were multiple things that we were able to uncover through ingredients, and our authors really helped us bring those things to light. You know, there was sort of a hive mind mentality because everyone approaches it a little bit differently, but we're so lucky to work with the incredible talent that we work with. I mean, the people that...
Yeah, well, your graphics designer has this all drawn together to make sense. I mean, she's wonderful.
And that was it. Oh, thank you. Yeah, she's fantastic. And, you know, and that was that was a challenge, but it was an exciting one, was a way to make it all feel cohesive and not just like a bunch of disparate voices. So Nick and I wrote all of the head notes, but we did, you know, we chatted with the authors and they provided kind of their own stories and notes with each recipe as they were testing it and creating it.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say that I'm really impressed. You have a very a snappy writing style that makes a lot of sense.
It's like, thank you very much.
It has a built-in humor to it, a built-in savvy to it. Without, you know, we've had cookbooks that are just totally off the wall coming through. You know, that we went through that phase where everything was a comic book. I think I have another one of those coming through also. but this is snappy and smart, and yet it's not forced. It's a very natural, I think, result of both of your writing styles.
Well, thank you. And we had such a great time doing it and putting it together and working together on it. So,
and how did you select your writers? You have a lot of them. How many do you have?
we had over 20, and it was a mixture of folks who had written a short stack already. So a handful of these authors already have short stack editions, small books that have been published. And then the ones that, in addition to those, we asked writers that we have been in conversations with to create short stacks in the future, but maybe we haven't gotten their book out quite yet. You know, they're coming in the next 2 to 3 years.
But these are people you knew or you just admired their writing or what?
It's a mixture. I mean, definitely we admire their writing. I think that was the first barrier to entry, is we wanted to make sure that these recipes work. So we were careful to only, you know, entrust this contributor's role with folks that we trusted and whose recipes we love. And that's the barometer for all short stack editions, the small books too, is, you know, we want the recipes to work. We want people to cook from them. You know, they're not just supposed to be design objects to sit on a coffee table. They're supposed to be approachable and they're supposed to be used in your kitchen. So it starts with that. It starts with seeking out the folks that we know are going to come up with, great recipes that people will turn to again and again.
Do people solicit samples to you? Do people approach you about writing these books?
Yes, we get lots of pitches. We're lucky at this point with the small books that we have our calendar booked out through 2018. Really what we could have it booked out into 2020 if we wanted to, but we're being cautious about booking that far in advance just to make sure that we're in the same place and that the ingredients are still in the right frame of mind, I guess, for their authors and people, their plans change. But we get a ton of pitches from lots of qualified authors and individuals. We definitely really set out to be a company that puts the author first. So that's the hugest compliment for us, is that people want to work with us. And we're really grateful to our authors, both past and present and future, for making that happen, because, without them, we have nothing.
Okay, let's jump to ingredients. I mean,
sure.
How did you narrow it down to just these ingredients?
Well, it was quite a task. And Nick, my co-author, and I, at first we put together a list of probably 50 ingredients. And we both had ones that we were, very attached to and really fought for. And some of those made it in and some of those didn't. And it was always a little bit of a debate. We sat on the floor of his apartment, over the coffee table, having cocktails and fighting about things like celery and black pepper, deciding whether or not those would make the cut. And, the thing that I think ultimately helped us narrow it down is we wanted each of the ingredients to serve as a bit of a microcosm to talk about something bigger, which I mentioned earlier, some larger trend or pattern in the food world, as a way that we could make the scope of the book a bit broader than just simply recipes and ingredients. So that was really what helped us narrow it down. And we also just wanted it to be something, we wanted a balance. So we didn't want to do all seasonal ingredients. There are a few more, I guess, pantry staples, if you will, or things that you keep in the fridge that aren't quite as, season reliant. Like bacon is a great example of something that most people, they wouldn't. Bacon has no season. Every day is a bacon day, as far as I'm concerned.
They're not the bacon people, I know. Some of these recipes are really creative. It's sort of, I don't think of food writers as creating recipes. I always think of cooks and chefs creating these kinds of recipes.
Yeah, I think that these food writers, it's kind of a mixed thing, because they have worked with, many of them have worked with, some of the most well-known chefs today.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think you learn, I've co-written books with chefs before, and I think you learn a lot from that experience.
It's kind
but
of
also
a nightmare. I did one of those too. That's kind of a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. So, it can be, it all depends, I guess, on the chef, but I think that you learn a lot. And then a lot of these folks that we work with were recipe creators and developers and testers in food magazines.
Okay.
So they come from the back. They're the people behind the recipes you love in Gourmet, back when that was still around, and uh-huh. Bon Appetit, and, you know, so they were all quite creative and talented and savvy when it came to suggesting recipe ideas and then, you know, bringing them into life.
But you and your partner were the final word on which ingredients got in this book.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Do people
and
write
we,
to you?
We both developed a few recipes as well. So there are a couple in there that are ours.
which ones are those?
Oh, more than I could probably list. The one that I think I'm most proud of that I did was the, there's one called the Room Service Tomato Sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
And it's basically a gussied up tomato sandwich, which, you know, I live in North Carolina, so I'm an adopted Southerner. And the tomato sandwich is like a religion here. It's, you know, tomatoes, mayonnaise, bread, that's it.
So I
took some liberties.
Yeah, well, mayo is not part of my tomato sandwich.
Really? And everyone does it a little bit differently.
Everybody puts mayo on. Mine was not, but anyhow. I've already gone through here and picked out a number of recipes that I intend to make.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, one of them is, I mean, I know I should adore Brussels sprouts, but, you know, I'm like all those other people. I really don't like them much at all. Unless, of course, you souse them with bacon a lot. But I thought this one was really interesting. Brussels sprouts slaw with herbs and peanuts. And it includes rice wine, fresh lime juice, and Asian fish sauce. Now, what kind of a person invented that recipe?
I believe
green.
That one...
Can I make a plug into how this is organized? It's green, so therefore you look in the back of the book to the key and find that shade of green, because there are many, and then see who wrote it. And I think that's Raquel Pelsel.
Well, actually, I hope we're not confusing folks out there. Not every chapter was written by just one author. They're kind of mixed in. You know, Raquel wrote several recipes. She wrote one for the honey chapter, and she wrote one for the, what else? She wrote several, actually. So the Brussels sprouts chapter had a lot of different folks, contributing to it.
Oh, yeah, and also that every recipe has somebody specific, right?
Right, exactly. So, but that slaw is really amazing. I love the idea of giving it sort of an Asian spin with the fish sauce. I think that really opens it up. And Brussels sprouts has that natural funk to it, which I think fish sauce complements so well. So that one was very delicious. I remember when we tested that one, it was pretty popular.
Yeah, well, I'm going to make that one. What was the other one I was going to make? I don't like the poppy seed pavlova because I'm traditionalist with pavlova.
Fair enough.
I thought the cured egg yolks, I've read that recipe in other places, and I thought that was good. It's sort of a poor man's botargo, right?
Exactly, yep. And it's so easy when you think about it. It just takes some patience, but pretty easy, just salt and sugar and eggs.
Yeah, and what about having oysters pop up in the chili peppers chapter?
Yep. So that one was contributed by Tyler Cord, who's actually a chef. He owns Number 7 in Brooklyn and Number 7 Sub, and he just came out with a cookbook on sandwiches. And
oh, really?
He wrote our broccoli edition, which was edition number 7, and he is quite a character. We love working with him because his recipes are always pretty different and definitely not something you've ever seen before. So he came up with that oysters recipe, which is sort of a play on oysters Rockefeller. It's got some chorizo and some pickled chilies and some spinach. So there are the elements of Rockefeller a little bit, and they're roasted, and it's just a really fun, playful, delicious dish. But the chili component definitely comes out in the chorizo and in the pickled chilies. That's what really sets it all off. So,
now, are you going to, if this book's successful, do a second book on a new set of ingredients?
You know, we've talked about it, and I think we would love, you know, we're definitely open to that that happening. I think the one thing we've figured out is that there's no shortage of passion when it comes to ingredients. You know, everyone gets excited about something. And again, like we still owe it to celery and black pepper to write another book and get them in there. All of the ingredients that we ended up not including, I think both Nick and I feel passionate about giving them space somewhere. So I think we'd be open to it, but we don't have those plans set
at
this point.
Keep notes on all the ingredients people are attached to. They send you letters saying, why isn't this in there? Why isn't that in there?
Right, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
You must come back and see us again when the second version comes out. And
I would love to.
In the meantime, I guess the short stack is probably getting taller by the minute, and that's going to continue. So thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, who doesn't like soup? I happen to love soup. I'm sure not everybody does, but most people do. And the author, Betty Rosbottom, is absolutely iconic in the field. She has a cooking school. She's published endless cookbooks. And she hit on a great topic, got praise from everybody around, called Soup Nights. And you'll find not only the soups themselves, but various accompaniments in which make this into a complete meal, and as the temperature falls, it's a good way of warming up and getting in the mood for a winter. For years now, I've seen this byline, Betty Rosbottom, and now we're finally getting to interview her, and I'm so excited, Betty, because you've been doing this so thoroughly and reliably for so long, and you came out with a subject that I love, which is soups. The title of the book is Soup Nights, and the subtitle is Satisfying Soups and Sides for Delicious Meals All Year. And I've been reading it with such delight. However did you come up with all these recipes?
Oh, isn't that the best question to always ask? Well, I think I'm like a little detective. I'm always on the lookout for a good recipe that will give me an idea for something that I'm working on. So while I was working on soups, I was lucky enough to be in Paris, where I was eating out in little bistros and cafes. I also go to farmers markets, whether it's here in my New England town or away in Paris, and I get ideas from the merchants. And once you have that idea in your mind, then you come back and you test and you work and you rework and you draft, and the final product is something you hope that everybody will enjoy.
Well, I mean, I love soups year-round. Do I detect some Southern in your accent?
Yes, you do, absolutely. I grew up in the South in Memphis, and I was lucky enough to go to college in New Orleans, which is a great eating town.
Okay, because you have gumbos in here that I'm going to
make. I do. I was brought up eating gumbo as a child. My grandparents lived just north of New Orleans, and I have a Louisiana-style gumbo in there. I love the food of the South. There's a red beans and rice soup in there.
I saw that. Yeah, I love it, too. I love New Orleans in particular. I just adore it.
Me, too.
Oh, by the way, this is one to watch out for, listeners. When you buy this book and you go to the Louisiana gumbo page, it looks like there's no seafood in it. You have to turn the page over.
There's lots of seafood in there. There's shrimp in there and scallops.
They're all on the turnover of the next page.
Yes, that's right.
I thought maybe you'd left them out.
No way. They're beautiful. I was really fortunate with this book. They're beautiful photographs. The photographer took so much time and attention to details, and the result is, I think, that dishes that you'll look at and really want to make.
Yeah, well, I mean, your publisher is Rizzoli, which, I mean, they do a great job.
Yes, they do. I was thrilled to have a chance to work with them. But, you know, I think wherever you are, you ask Ian about the ideas for the recipes. Wherever you are, if you're a food person, and in my case, food professional, I am always looking for different thoughts of how to do things. And when I go to any city before I book the hotel, I look at the restaurants and book those.
Oh, we all do. Everybody does.
Yes.
Now, you have different chapters here.
I do.
Yeah, and you have warming vegetable soups, chowders, gumbo, and bisques from the sea, new and classic bean and grain soups, which is one of the things I'm really attracted to, hearty comfort soups, light soups, warm or chilled, salads for all season, which leads us into the next thing. Not only do you have the soups themselves, but you have a little section, you have a little box that says soup night menu, and you suggest the accompaniments, the soup, the salad, and the dessert, no less.
That's right. I, you know, as I said, I'd worked on a soup book earlier and loved it, and when it came time to think about doing another soup book, I thought, you know, I had a few salads, a few sandwiches in with my last book, but I really wanted to expand that idea. So there's a whole chapter given over to salads, not complicated salads, but salads that would complement a soup, in that they are vinaigrettes or citrus dressings and fresh vegetables, fresh greens. And then, you know, what else is a partner to soup but sandwiches? And so there's a chapter on sandwiches that would go with them, and a final chapter on desserts, which I confess are my favorite part of almost any meal.
Oh,
so there are a sizable number of desserts in the book.
When I asked you about how you thought of these recipes, we just we interviewed Dory Greenspan about her cookie book, Dory's Cookies.
Oh, Dory. I know Dory. She's such a fabulous baker and a wonderful cookbook writer.
And she said that she sometimes dreams her recipes. She gets them in a dream.
I can't say that's happened to me, but what I can say is that I'll go to bed worried about a recipe, something that, you know, say a soup in this book that we've been working on. And I'll sleep on it, and the next morning when I wake up, I kind of have the solution to what was wrong with it. And they say your brain works during the night, and I think mine does do that when I'm working on a cookbook, because the morning seems to bring the answers to the problems.
Now, you don't deal with just newly created recipes. You give twists to some pretty established ones, like chicken noodle soup.
Oh, that's one of my favorite recipes in the book. I guess we all say that about different recipes. But, you know, the chicken noodle soup I had as a youngster came out of a red and white Campbell's can. And I thought it was great. You know, I ate it, and I had saltine crackers that went with it. But when I was doing this book, I really wanted to do it scratch. And I made a good but a shortcut broth, used fresh chicken breast. But what made it different is I sautéed wild mushrooms, and these were packaged fresh wild mushrooms that I got at our local Whole Foods, but I give a mix that you can put together from any market you shop in.
Uh-huh.
So I added those, I added a touch of vermouth, and I added some Parmigiano, and of course there's always the pasta in it, and I used the little short noodle pasta, and I had a group of volunteer testers for the book, and this is one of their favorites. They all came back and said that they would make this just any time, especially when it gets cool like it is now.
Yeah, Peter likes, he makes chicken soup.
I do. I haven't made chicken soup in a long time.
No, we're
this is a good one. I mean, I really like the way the flavors go together. I wouldn't have thought of putting vermouth in it, but right about the time I was testing this recipe, I had been to my book club, and my book club often serves soup and salad for our meetings, and one of the hosts served a chicken soup, not a chicken noodle soup, but it had a little bit of vermouth in it, and I thought it was such a great addition that I added it to the one in this soup book.
You know, I have one.
Do you have the essential ingredients of chicken soup according to Miss Ann?
I don't know, but Miss Ann maybe might want to tell me what they are.
No, I can tell you because I'm the one who's the maker now. One thing is it has to have parsnips in it.
Yeah, it has to be chicken thighs, though, not breast.
Has to have dill in it.
Dill? No, you got to make both of them. I have white meat, and I don't have parsnips or dill, but I think I have a little rosemary in it. And, you know, I think chicken soup has so many wonderful variations. And if you were making this soup and you wanted to substitute dill for the rosemary, that'd be fine because it's that broth and it's the tender chicken meat and the noodles that give it its warming, comforting presentation, I think.
Right. Well, the big advantage of using chicken thighs is you get even more skin.
Yes.
So after you pull the skin off, you can fry the skins.
That's what he does.
Oh.
Oh, they are
he doesn't cook them with the soup. He takes
the skins off and fry them.
Yeah. For his lunch.
I like fried chicken skins. You know, I grew up in the South. That's not so far from the bacon rinds we had.
Right.
Now, you talk about vermouth. You know, I make an old, it's been out of print forever, Vincent Price cookbook.
Oh, I had that cookbook. I know that cookbook.
Well, he has a mushroom soup in there to die for, and the secret ingredient is sweet vermouth, sweet Italian vermouth.
Oh, wow.
And you
wow.
only use, like, 2 spoonfuls. And so we would buy one bottle, and it would last us 20 years.
Because every time you made that soup. Well, this has dry vermouth, but just like your recipe, it calls for a very small amount. It's only 4 tablespoons, and it's for a recipe that serves 6, so it's not even a tablespoon per person.
Is that the general number that you plan these for?
No, they will vary. I try to make as many as possible for 6, but some of them are for 4. None are for less than 4.
A few might be for 8.
Yeah, but 6 seems to be a good working number. You know, it's hard when you do a recipe and you say, okay, how many does this yield? How many servings would this yield? Because for me, a serving might be a certain size, and for somebody else, it might be smaller or bigger. So I try to find a happy medium in between. And so these really range from 4 to 6. But the good thing about most soups, and most in this book, is that you can make them ahead. You can make them a couple of days ahead, or you can make them ahead and freeze them. And you can also have soup one day and wait a couple of days and have it again.
That's very good, yes.
So it's a ready meal on a busy night you have a leftover soup in your...
No, when I make chicken soup, I don't make it by the person, I make it by the week.
Oh, that's great. That is absolutely the right way to do it.
So we have it for lunch and dinner for about 4 days, and then it's mostly gone.
Yeah, no, but I don't tire of it. I really find what I like is that you can have soup all year long. Right now in New England, and I'm sure it's the same in Pennsylvania, it's cool, and we're beginning to have the first frost and the first really chilly days.
That's true. So,
you know, I love making soup from now through April, but my soup making in the spring changes, and I do lighter soups like asparagus and pea soups. And then in the summer, I do lots of chill soups. So you can have soup every day of the year. You can. It's that versatile.
Yeah, I like asparagus in the summer.
Now, does Mr. Ross Bottom sometimes put his hands up in the air and say, no mas?
He does sometimes, but he's pretty good about soup. He's a fabulous tester. He does not make anything in the kitchen. He's a professor. But when I say, I'm working on this, tell me what you think about it, he's very good at sampling it and saying it needs this, or I'd like a little more heat in it, or that sort of thing. So he gets lots of kudos for that.
See, Anne does that for me.
Oh, that's great.
But she always says, a little more salt.
I haven't given up salt. And one very, I think, important aspect about this book is most soups are made with broth or stock, which are really kind of interchangeable. But when you go to buy it, I give recipes for made-from-scratch stock, whether it's chicken, beef, or vegetable. I give shortcut versions, And I also say that I rely on purchase stock a lot. And one thing I debated quite seriously for this book was whether to put low-sodium stock. And I decided against it. And the reason was that the variance between what was labeled low-sodium could be as low as 70 milligrams of salt and as high as 400 or above. And I was afraid people would be afraid to add the salt that they needed to get the flavor to come out.
No,
of course,
right,
if you're on a specific diet, you might be monitoring your sodium intake. But for most people, I want them to know that salt is in the stock or the broth and that it's needed to bring out the flavors that are producing this particular soup.
Yeah, the one I like is the largest possible size that they have at Whole Foods. They're 365, and it's a really big box.
Yes, no, I tried every kind of commercial stock I could. I did Whole Foods 365. I did vegetarian, organic stocks. I did Swanson's. I did collagen. In the end, I felt that for my needs, Swanson's did the best job. They had a vegetable stock that I could use as a base and enrich, and they had wonderful chicken stocks and broths, and I used them the most. But I suggest as a tip to readers under the section in the back on stocks that they try out the various stocks that are available and just taste them and see which one they like best.
Right. Now, you've talked about your favorites. Do you have an overall favorite?
In the book?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that would be like picking a child, wouldn't it?
I know, that's a dumb
but
question.
But I will say this. Let's say you're in a really hurry and you've had a rush day and you'd like to put some kind of meal on the table. There's a soup I turn to every time, and again, the testers liked it a lot. It takes about 15 minutes to put together. It's delicious.
Which one?
And it's called broccoli soup with curried creme fraiche.
Oh, I saw that.
Under the vegetarian or vegetable chapters there. They're made with stock, or you can substitute vegetable stock. But that soup, to me, just gives such a good flavor for a minimum of time, and it's homemade and it's fresh. You can put one of the salads or you can put one of the sandwiches with it. And I'd say it's one of my real go-to soups in this collection.
Okay, you have creme fraiche in there.
Creme fraiche, and I don't know if your listeners can get it. We can get it even in my small town of Amherst, Mass. Creme fraiche is sold at all the stores, but if your readers can't, there's a recipe for making it in the back of the book.
Which is pretty straightforward and simple.
Right. Yes, I do it just with heavy cream or whipping cream and sour cream, and you just whisk it together and leave it out overnight in a fairly, not a freezing place in your kitchen. But, no, it's not hard to make, and I buy it a lot now.
Yes, that's true, yeah. Well, I think it's a wonderful book, and as I told you, I'm looking at two dinner parties, and I want to pick two soups and accompany them out of this book because it would be something a little different from what we usually serve.
Oh, I think that'd be great, and I'd love to hear what you pick and how it's received.
You got it.
Okay.
So, Betty Rossbottom, thank you so much for the book and for talking to us about the book.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I'm just delighted to meet you both for the first time, and I hope there'll be another time.
I expect there will be. You're very, very productive in the cookbook line.
I like to write cookbooks, but I love being able to talk about them, and you've given me a wonderful opportunity to tell people about this book, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Betty.
Okay, so if you don't know what to cook tonight,
try soup.
Well, what else can we do to help? We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week for more help on what to do in the kitchen and other things about the wonderful world of food and drink that we all enjoy so much. So until then,
bye-bye.